into this edition of the Golf Show Podcast with Rex and Lavo. Rex, it was another Sunday to remember on the PGA Tour, and I think actually another reminder that it's really hard to win on the PGA Tour. You look at what's happened over the past couple weeks. First, it was Jacob Bridgman, who nearly gave it up at Riviera despite leading by 7 shots early in the final round. Just last week at the Cognizant Classic, it was Shane Lowry, who was up by 3 with 3 to play, didn't even force overtime. And this time, it was Daniel Berger, who had a 4-shot lead heading to the back nine at Bay Hill, ends up falling in a playoff to Akshay Bhatia. I would call this a proper tournament on the PGA Tour. Great storylines, great battle, great golf course, at least competition-wise. What say you about Sunday?
I think Bug was up 5 on Akshay with 9 to play, if I'm not mistaken, according to our friends on XM Radio. And you're absolutely right. That's what I was thinking of. It's so hard to win on the PGA Tour. And it's going to sound like a cliche, but everybody makes a run in the fourth quarter in the NBA. Well, everyone's going to make a run on Sunday on the PGA Tour. And then you factor in how difficult the golf course was. I mean, the conditions weren't easy on Sunday. It was a little bit warmer than we'd seen earlier in the week, but the wind was blowing. The golf course had baked out. We saw how thick the rough was coming down the stretch. And Berger just didn't do the things that he had been doing all week long, which is really hitting his ball where he was looking every single time. He still was solid off the tee, but if you sort of take a deeper dive into strokes gained off the tee, he missed it where he couldn't. He missed it in some really bad spots, specifically down the right side of 18 in regulation and the left side on 18 in the playoff. You just can't miss in those areas where the rough is going to be so thick, and you have to be able to control your golf ball. But you're right. This is all about it's hard to win on the PGA Tour. I think this is a little bit different than what we ran into Shane Lowry last week. I felt like Shane Lowry probably opened the door a little bit more than Daniel Berger, but it was hard to watch sometimes.
Yeah, look, I think it's really hard to win the PGA Tour. I think it's especially hard to go wire to wire, particularly at a place like Bay Hill. And I think it was certainly a less scary setup over the weekend. You were out there on Saturday. They had a significant downpour that briefly suspended play, but at least it put some friction on the greens. It made them liven up, even if for only 24 to 36 hours, made them slightly more receptive with some of the iron shots. But I think when you zoom out, like, there's just so many macho shots that are required at Arnie's Place where you really just have to stand up there and hit it. There's a lot of water. There's a lot of trouble. There's a lot of places that are absolutely dead, and you could make bogey or double bogey really quick. And so for Daniel Berger, who was vying to go wire to wire at this golf tournament, again, having a pretty significant lead on the back nine, you know it was going to be very difficult. I'm not sure I quite saw it ending that way, though, Rex, right? With 3 bogeys in his last 7 holes, Akshay Bhatia going absolutely nuclear on the back nine. I mean, for most of Sunday, I thought this thing was a snoozer. What did you think was really the turning point?
Well, from the first hole, it was a 2-stroke swing. So now all of a sudden he went from 1-stroke up because he didn't finish strong. I'm talking about Daniel Berger on Saturday.
It was a 2-shot swing on Sunday morning as well, with him making bogey and Akshay making birdie on 18.
Yeah. So I think there's a lot of roller coasters there. But no, I'm with you. I didn't see it coming only because I kind of had to go back and look. And I don't want to take anything away from Bhatia. Let's be perfectly clear. He finished first in strokes gained putting. He picked up more than 10.5 shots on the field. He made 144 feet of putts just on Sunday, just in the final round. I mean, he putted lights out. I think they said it on
XM. One of the best putting performances we've seen in Bay Hill ever.
And those greens are not easy to putt. There's a lot of movement to them. It's subtle, but they're tough to read. As I said, they got crispy. The rain on Saturday did slow him down a little bit, but not enough. When you're looking at someone who was so desperate when it came to his putting earlier in his career that he stayed with whatever it is you want to call that, the broomstick, I guess is what you want to call it. So I don't want to take anything away from Akshay, but the part that gets me really about Bug is he was doing the one thing you have to do well at Bay Hill. You said it's a big boy golf course. You have to stand on so many tee shots and just execute shots. There's nowhere to bail out. And again, 18 is a perfect example. I think 16 is a really good example that everyone wanted to bail out right. I had some friends of mine who are actually volunteers there this week. He was telling me that all week long, just trees just ricocheting through the branches. It felt like it was a war zone over there because it's the only place to bail out.
Way too close on 16. I mean, what do we? The pin was right on 16 one of the days, and those guys are getting absolutely pelted with golf balls. Push it back.
And the pond's been moved in on 17. That really tough par three. So where you did maybe have a bit of a margin for error, you could actually put it down on the beach if you were kind of short and right. Now that's just water. Now you're just dead there. There's so many holes like that out at Bay Hill. And I think that what you end up with is a situation where, as good as Daniel looked, certainly to start the week out with a 63, and he seemed to be in complete control. And keep in mind, he played last week at the Cognizant Classic. I had a chance to talk to him on Thursday. He had a lot of confidence in his game. It's still tough to close these things out. I mean, I still think that sometimes we dismissed whatever it is that players are wrestling with internally. Like, maybe externally, yes, you can execute all the shots. I think last Sunday on this pod, we tried to dissect whatever it was that Shane Lowry was going through and what got in his head. Maybe it was him thinking about his daughter waiting for him behind the 18th green and that celebration. She'd never seen him win before. In this particular case, maybe it was Berger, who has gone through so much. And I kept thinking to myself as I kind of walked a little bit with him today just to get a vibe for how he was playing, that if a player like a Will Zalatoris, who we're all sort of holding our breath and hoping that he's okay after a strange WD 2 weeks ago at the Cognizant Classic, if Justin Thomas, who just came back at Bay Hill after a six-month layoff following back surgery, didn't come back well, by the way, back-to-back rounds of 79, ooh, did not get off to a great start. But if either one of them needed a paradigm of hope, it's Berger, right? I mean, he lives in South Florida. They can talk to those guys all the time. There was a point in his career where I think the general vibe was he might be washed. He might not be able to recover from this. I mean, it was significant back issues and surgeries for a player at that age, always sets off alarm bells. And so you have to sort of celebrate the fact that he has turned it around and he has sort of put himself right on the doorstep of being a world-class player. But again, this goes into the psyche of a world-class player. Whatever it is he was thinking of, whatever it is he was trying to execute coming down the stretch, some of the conversations between he and his caddy, Josh, were fascinating to me.
Yeah, they certainly were fascinating. And I don't want to overlook what Daniel Berger has overcome. He was trying to win for the first time in 5 years. He missed 19 months, as you mentioned, because of a lower back injury. We thought that we might not be seeing Daniel Berger on the PGA Tour once again. He basically missed, Rex, like when you think of that time frame, he basically missed the entire arrival of Scottie Scheffler back to 2022, 2023 season. Like, it's crazy to think about, knowing what we do now about Scotty. What you've seen over the past couple years with Daniel Berger, got his way back into form, played his way into the signature events by making the BMW Championship last year, last fall. And what happens at the BMW? He breaks his right ring finger, thinks it's going to be just a multi-week injury, ends up missing about 4 months. And so it's been a little bit of a slow burn to 2026 as well, trying to find his form as well. I've always liked watching Boog. I've always loved sort of the way that he carries himself, sort of that he plays a little bit above his weight. And by that, I mean, he's a four-time PGA Tour winner. You could maybe mistake him as someone who has won 14 or 40 times on the PGA Tour. He just sort of has that confidence overflowing. It might even mistake it for cockiness. But what you saw at Bay Hill was vintage Boog, of hitting that squeeze cut over and over and over again, chasing down the fairways, very accurate, at least except for the final couple hours of this golf tournament. He was flagging his irons, one of the best iron plays players in the field at Bay Hill, rocks out on the greens again, at least until the past couple hours. And so very encouraging to see that from Daniel Berger. You didn't answer my question, Rex, of what you think the turning point was, because when I think back of the back nine, I didn't really think much of it at the time, but Akshay made about a 55-footer on 11, and it just seemed like a nice moment. At that point, I believe he got within three shots. But when you think about all of the fun head-to-head moments between those two over the past 90 minutes, like, this was great. Like, Berger making the huge mistake on 13 with a wedge. We're recording this right after Akshay just tapped into win, so we don't have the interview transcript quite yet from Daniel Berger. Very curious to know if that was a mud ball on 13, the fact that he missed his target by 15, 20 yards with a wedge, very, very strange. Two shots.
17. I mean, I know that's being a prisoner of the moment, but now that I kind of look at it, and if you're going to press me to answer your question, which
I mean, 15, I thought was going to be a moment with Akshay going cross-handed, chipping. Bones sort of guessed that that was because he wanted to apply more spin to his chip shot, but we really hadn't seen him do that in that spot, especially for a shot that didn't seem to require additional sip making bogey there. I thought like that was going to be Boog's tournament. What does Akshay do 10 minutes later? It's one of the shots of his life. He really makes an albatross on 16, tap an eagle from about 3 feet as well. And so there was so many like little back and forth moments. That was a great deal. I was sort of kidding with a friend that I didn't like Dan Hicks's call that this was, you know, one of the greatest duels we've ever seen at Bay Hill. It actually ended up becoming one, thanks in large part to what Akshay Bhatia did with the final night.
There was some hyperbole there in Dan's call. Yeah. Is that what you were thinking in the heat of the moment? And then all of a sudden it delivered. Well, Dan's Dan.
how about Akshay though, Rex, where he now wins for the third time on the PGA Tour, all three in a playoff, showing some big game chops and stepping up to the task as well. You mentioned the short game, and I don't think that can really be overlooked. He has completely become now a well-rounded, all-around player on the PGA Tour. I think particularly when you look at his short game and his putting that was on display at Bay Hill.
Yeah, his short game, he was first in the field in strokes gained short game. He was obviously first in the field in strokes gained putting, as I pointed out. And it made me kind of look at the last couple of years, Russell Henley last year, Scottie Scheffler the year before that. That's not necessarily the recipe for success at Bay Hill. Normally, it's you have to strike your ball really well, and you have to putt decent, maybe above average, something around 10 or 15th in the field. You usually get it done if you're a Scottie Scheffler and you're hitting your golf ball like Scottie Scheffler does. But that wasn't what Akshay did. I think he went out and he played his normal game. I think if the winds would have come up a little bit more, he probably would have been challenged, because I'm always curious where he hits his driver. He launches it so high, and there's so much spin on that golf ball. And I think sometimes it's hard for him to control it. And he didn't necessarily have to deal with that most of the week, certainly Saturday. And the rains that came through sort of softened the place. But he did what he does best with his putter. He really took control of this on the greens. And you're right. I think being 3-for-3 in a playoff on the PGA Tour, I think that speaks volumes about what kind of mentality you have, where it's not easy because, I mean, everything that you're taught from a sports psychology standpoint on the PGA Tour, it's sort of counterintuitive to what you have to do when you get in a playoff. Because for 72 holes every single week of the year, you're taught, don't even look at who you're playing with. Put the blinders on. You're playing against the golf course. You're playing against yourself. And you just put the score down on the scorecard. And this particular case, when you get in a playoff, you have to gravitate to whatever it is that player is doing. I think we kind of saw that. And the player, my guess is, and you're right, we haven't seen what Akshay had to say about his approach in the playoff. But given the fact that Daniel's approach from the left rough came up well short, it was on the green, but it left about a 70-foot putt.
100-foot putt.
Given that, I'm sure he kind of changed his mentality, be a little bit more aggressive, put the pressure on Daniel that, yes, you have to two-putt that. I think it's a fun mentality, and I start to wonder if he could be one of those additions to match play, where I'm not necessarily promoting him to the U.S. team this year, although given the trajectory he's on, it's not out of the question at this point. But it shows a mentality that I think helps out in match play.
Yeah, he's got that dog in him, and I think that should give him so much confidence.
Thanks for dumbing that down for me. Yeah, he's got that dog in him. Appreciate that.
winning for the third time in a playoff, doing it on this golf course, doing it in come from behind fashion, doing it against this field. This is no disrespect to the Barracuda field. This is no disrespect to the Valero Texas Open field. This was a step up in stature and prestige that Akshay Bhatia just became a winner of a signature event on the PGA Tour as well. You mentioned the putting, and this was like historic stuff. The best at Bay Hill that we've seen in 11 years. Gained more than 16 shots on the field, around the greens and on the greens. And so, no, that is not typically the recipe for success at Bay Hill. You look at some of the recent winners, whether it was Terrell Hatton, or Francesco Molinari, certainly Scottie Scheffler goes in that category, the defending champion Russell Henley. Those are very position-oriented golfers, very smart golfers, very good golfers with their approach play. Akshay Bhatia won in spite of what was one of the least accurate players off the tee. His iron play picked it up over the weekend, certainly, which allowed him to sort of trigger this rally. But I mean, this was almost exclusively because of his chipping and his putting. So again, winning without your best ball striking stuff on the caliber of this and the difficulty of this golf course against those players, against this field, very, very impressive stuff for Akshay Bhatia. How about Scottie Scheffler, Rex? This is a player who I think we're all keen to see how he was going to play. Thought it was a pretty strange week. Tied for 24th, his worst result on the PGA Tour since the 2024 BMW Championship. You had an opportunity to see Scottie, talk to Scottie, listen to Scottie. What did you think? What did you hear? What do you know?
Well, twofold. You say we all wanted to see how he was going to play. We all wanted to see how he was going to start on Thursday. Let's be honest. And when he started with a 2-under round, he shot 70, which it wasn't great. It, you know, left him, I would say, a little bit above the middle of the pack. At least he was under par. And given the conversations that we've talked about and him waking up Thursday mornings on the PGA Tour and deciding he hates Thursdays, I felt like that was a step in the right direction. But the level of frustration that we saw from Scottie Scheffler really throughout the course of the weekend, more so than maybe those first two rounds, where you saw the frustration on the putting greens. You saw him just not just toss a ball into
chucking
the
him.
Water.
He's sidearm.
Ripping one. Yeah,
he was like a middle reliever who was coming in the bottom of the seventh, like trying to get out of a jam.
And I was not there. I think you misplaced me on Saturday. I did not go out to Bay Hill on Saturday, but I heard it from our intrepid reporter, Brentley Romine, who was out there and who said that Scottie was just scathing mad on Saturday when he came off the golf course. And you and I both have seen this, and it's not unreasonable to imagine that that's would be his reaction to, I think, three putting the 18th green for a double bogey. He's going to get aggravated. And I guess the question marks now going into the Players Championship is, under any circumstances in any universe, and you and I got a text message from my middle son, Trevor, just a few days ago asking about who he and his apparently gambling degenerate friends should be betting on next week. You and I are not very good at this, so I'm not quite sure why he came to us for betting advice, but at the top of the list would be Scottie. I still argue, to answer your question, that it should be Scottie, but I don't know what the margins are now because he's clearly, let's call it a half a beat off, I think would be fair. Like something
okay.
Just not
so.
Quite,
so, in, so
quite
instead
right?
of being instead of being 3-1 or 4-1, he's probably going to be 5-1. He's going to be plus 500, which I've heard is the same thing as 5-1. I do think there are some reasonable, I wouldn't even call them concerns. I think they're just like things to monitor. And I think his attitude was one of them, like commenting, bristling about the quote unquote dead greens that we saw at Bay Hill. I think was a little bit curious because Daniel Berger through two rounds was 13 under par and absolutely lighting it up on the green. So it certainly was possible to do so. I think most particularly, Rex, something that I'm going to continue to monitor. This was like my thing to watch heading into Bay Hill and was proven correct. And now I'm really going to watch at TPC Sawgrass where it's going to be under the microscope even more. Was this is the second straight week that Scottie Scheffler has lost strokes with his approach play. And to put that in context, Scottie Scheffler has not done that. Again, back-to-back weeks on tour, negative strokes gained approach. He has not done that since 2021. And you saw it over the course of the 4 days, battling a couple left misses. He had some really odd distance control issues over the first three rounds where he was missing, you know, 10, 15 yards short of a couple flags. I will say on Sunday, Scottie was much sharper. Again, he did not make a run at the leaders. In fact, he went backwards on the leaderboard. But from a proximity to the hole standpoint, he was 20 feet with his approach play, by far the best of any player on Sunday. And so that should give him some reasons for optimism. Potentially, he found something on the range Saturday night, Sunday morning that he can work off. Again, going into TPC Sawgrass in the Players' Championship, trying to become the first three-time winner of that event. One other thing to monitor, Rex, new driver in the bag. He had tinkered with it earlier in the season, went for the older model. The new model is in the bag this week. A little bit iffy. 53% driving accuracy over the four rounds. I thought, interestingly, non-committal about keeping it in the bag for the proclaimed, self-described fifth major.
We can get to that a little bit later. I will say it is interesting. His frustration seemed to stem from his putting, and you're right. The ball striking stats weren't quite what we've come to expect from Scottie Scheffler. However, if you look at statistically, he lost strokes to the field just on one day. That was Saturday. I think that was the day when he was really frustrated with his putting. And as I think a lot of players pointed out, the greens at Bay Hill, they were crispy to start the week. And so by the time we got to Sunday, they were pretty shiny, even with the rains we ended up with on Saturday night. And I will also point out that Randy Smith, his longtime swing coach, will be with him next week at Sawgrass. So you're right. we're talking about percentage points here. I mean, he's still going to be the favorite. It's just a matter of how much Vegas wants to make him a favorite. But I just feel like at this point in the season, and you're excluding what happened at Amex because that was a dominant performance, but ever since then, he has looked a shade off.
And even I thought at the Amex, that was not his top gear. I did not think that was his A-plus game, even though he was going to
win by five
or six. He was gonna win by five, six, seven shots before the double bogey on the 17th hole at PJ West. He's just been missing a little bit more left than we've grown accustomed to. It's obvious with his approach play. He is peerless in that regard. No one has even come close to touching him since 2022 with his approach play and his iron game. Definitely a shade off. He's more middle of the pack this season on the PGA Tour, as opposed to being the peerless dominant world number one that we've grown accustomed to. So questions about Scotty. Rex, we also have some questions about the defending champion at the Players. That is Rory McIlroy, who withdrew before the start of the third round, tweaked something in his back in the gym, decided it sounds like trying to be cautious about it, sort of out of an abundance of caution, you could say, harkening back to the COVID era, to not tee it up over the weekend, get some treatment at home in South Florida, anticipating he's going to be playing in the Players' Championship and will be on the property on Tuesday. What's your level of concern as it relates to Rory, who actually looked pretty decent over the first 36 holes before, again, he tweaked something in his back on Saturday?
Yeah, I think he was tied for ninth when he withdrew after two rounds. So it's not as though he was playing poorly. And it's a golf course where he's had success before. He's talked a lot about his affinity for Arnold Palmer, and took a long time for him to decide to play there in his career. But once he did, he sort of made this commitment to always be there for Arnold's legacy. Yeah, I mean, Todd Lewis did some really good reporting on this one. I really think that this just boils down to there was a tweak in his back. He didn't like the way it felt, by all accounts. I spoke with someone inside his camp. He tried to warm up, and it just kind of became more and more uncomfortable as it went. My guess is it wasn't the week before the quote-unquote fifth major, the Players' Championship, he probably would have kept playing, but he doesn't want to jeopardize anything. He knows how big next week is. So my level of concern would be pretty low. I don't know if you want me to put a number on it since you're pressing me on answers these days, but it's not very high.
All right. So you're not very high level of concern. Anything else stand out to you about what happened at the Arnold Palmer Invitation? I know you're out there, if not on Saturday, at least for a couple of days. Anything, whether it was JT's return, Xander popping up, Colin Morikawa with another good performance in his first start on the Florida swing, Cam Young, Ludvig Åberg trending in the right direction. What else caught your eye, Rex?
I mentioned JT, Justin Thomas, making his first start on the PGA Tour in 6 months following back surgery. And I was going to let Rory do the speaking for this because I thought this was a brilliant answer. When JT told Rory that Bay Hill was going to be his first tournament back after 6 months away from the PGA Tour, Rory's response was, and I quote, woof. It was not the best option. And in his defense, what are you going to do?
Xander did it last year.
Yeah, what are you going to do? Come back a week early and play the Cognizant, or come back a week late and play TPC Sawgrass? It's not like either one of those two courses are cupcakes. So if you're not going to play Amex, if you're not going to play, even Innisbrook is pretty tough. I don't know that there are any cupcakes on the schedule, but certainly Bay Hill seemed like an extremely difficult test for him to test the waters. I don't necessarily have a level of concern when it comes to JT, but I will be keeping an eye on him next week.
As it relates to your son, Trevor, who wanted, again, the gambling advice, I would be keeping a very close eye on Colin Morikawa, who just continues to play well. And if you know anything about what it's going to take at TPC Sawgrass, it is just relentless iron play, hitting to the right spots on the greens. That is what we've seen over the past couple of years in the winters and sort of the profiles that they have, particularly with the overseed. It's been absolutely perfect weather in the run-up to this championship. Precision, proximity to the hole are all going to be very, very crucial components of a winner's success at TPC Sawgrass. I like Colin Morikawa. I don't know what his number is going to be. I haven't seen that over the past couple of hours, but I do like Colin Morikawa, trying to build on last year's performance. I believe that was his best, tied for 10th.
I will slide in here, and thanks to our friends at DraftKings, Scottie Scheffler is currently the favorite, plus 355, followed by Rory, Xander, and then your friend Colin Morikawa slides in essentially as the fourth favorite at plus 2,400.
So maybe I'm getting better at this because I said Scottie was most likely to be 3-1 or 4-1. Look at us, folks.
We're not getting worse, at least.
Like we know what we're doing. I'm not sure if you've been following Rex, but there was also a secondary tournament on the PGA Tour, the Puerto Rico Open, won by Ricky Castillo, who I thought was an interesting story, narrowly missed retaining full status in 2025. But I think he showed, if nothing else, just how good of a card that sort of conditional is, right? From 101 to 110. This is his fifth start of the season, tied for fifth last week at the Cognizant Classic, just wins for the first time on the PGA Tour. I was most interested in seeing how Blades Brown was going to fare on Sunday. Remember, played in the final group with Scottie Scheffler at the Amex, had another opportunity to win in Puerto Rico, which would have given him a two-year exemption, had the lead outright on the back nine before making triple bogey after trying to attempt a hero shot out of a fairway bunker. Rex, he would have become the youngest winner on the PGA Tour in nearly a century. Instead, the solo third, very important as he tries to lock up special temporary membership on the PGA Tour, which would grant him the opportunity to have unlimited sponsor exemptions for the remainder of the season, which is obviously very important.
It's interesting to watch his growth really in real time, week by week, tournament by tournament, because I'll go back to Amex last year when he was playing on a sponsor exemption. I think that was his first sponsor exemption. And I was impressed just with sort of how he handled the spotlight. The focus was really on him that week. And he played decent, not great. And then, of course, what he ended up doing at this year's American Express. And this goes along with, and his swing coach is a friend of the program. You and I have spent a lot of time talking with Justin Parsons, and I've had a chance to talk with Justin about how you have sort of put a teenager into this grinder that is the PGA Tour, and you've expected him to mature at an alarmingly fast pace. And I think in a lot of ways, he actually has. In a lot of ways, I think he still needs to make up ground. But a finish like this, even though I'm sure he walks away disappointed, just like I'm sure he walked away from the American Express finish disappointed, it's a huge step forward. If for nothing else, it just gives you more opportunities. And that's all he's asking for at this point in his career. He'll now have more opportunities to play in tour events, have more opportunities to test himself against the world's best. Because I think both you and I were in the same mindset last year. He had a couple good starts on the Korn Ferry Tour, and I think we actually discussed it on the pod, the idea that maybe he would have been better off focusing on the Korn Ferry Tour. If the ultimate goal is to get to the PGA Tour, splitting your time probably isn't the best way of doing it. That's essentially what he did, and I think eventually it pays off. But in the short term, he's going to have to take some lumps. And I would say what happened in Amex was a bit of a lump. What happened this week is a bit of a lump, but it's all part of the growing process. And I think he can use this to sort of take that next step.
Yeah, at this point in his career, he should want opportunities and he should want experience. He's certainly getting opportunities via sponsor exemption on the PGA Tour. This is probably going to put him in a little bit of a pickle, to be honest with you, whether he wants to devote himself full time to the Korn Ferry Tour, try and finish inside the top 20 to get a fully exempt PGA Tour card that way. Now, does he chase the points? Obviously, a Puerto Rico Open, it is a reduced number of FedEx Cup points as in regards to like a full field PGA Tour event, non-signature event on the PGA Tour, just to reduce FedEx Cup point allocation that way. So he's going to have to decide at some point which route he wants to pursue, because unfortunately at this point in the season, both routes kind of look appealing. And although he's 19 and probably thinks he can play every single week, he's going to have to choose eventually. I love the experience angle, Rex, like playing in the final group at Amex, learning what that's like, being with Scottie Scheffler, now this experience leading outright on the PGA Tour, understanding how he was feeling in that moment as well. It's only going to help him in the long run. I can't say this enough. He is a teenager. He's a teenager. Akshay Bhatia was 17 when he first turned pro. Now, I think at the age of 24, we're finally seeing him be a complete player on the PGA Tour. Blades Brown, whatever, no matter what happened at the Puerto Rico Open, is very much ahead of the curve. Further down the leaderboard, love the story of Luke Clanton, who's had a really abysmal 2026, tying for fifth there. Gordon Sargeant, great to see him playing well again after a down couple of years. How about John Daly's son, Rex, playing in his very first PGA Tour event, playing as an amateur, was in the mix heading into Sunday before a back 940 derailed him and sent him skidding down the leaderboard. But great to see JD the second in the mix as well. All right, that's enough about the PGA Tour. Big story over on LIV was John Rahm winning in Hong Kong. Really capped, Rex, I thought, was an eventful week in which, one, John Rahm claimed that the European Tour was extorting players. Two, he helped commission a private plane to help rescue some of the affected players in the Middle East with the flight issues and the ongoing issues in Iran trying to get them to Hong Kong for the LIV event. And then, oh yeah, he won for the first time anywhere in 539 days. What do you make of Big John Rahm, Rambo, getting back in the winner's circle?
Well, the winner's circle thing is interesting, and I do want to touch on that. But I do want to touch on the dichotomy that is him calling it extortion with the DP World Tour. And you and I discussed this on the Wednesday podcast about the DP World Tour is trying to come up with ways to allow the players who left to go to LIV and maintain their membership on the European circuit to be able to do both without these enormous fines, without the contentiousness. The European circuit knows they're better off with these players, and so they worked with LIV to come up with this pathway. Nine players were offered the deal. Eight of the nine took it. John Rahm is the one that did not. I think there is some irony there. As a matter of fact, I think there, you know, might be some gaslighting there on his part. The idea that he doesn't like that the European Tour is now going to tell him that you have to play two extra events. They had to play four. Now he's going to play two extra, and they get to name what those two extra are. He does not like that. Well, the irony there is LIV Golf tells you exactly what 14 of it.
14 of them, yes.
Yeah, it's 14 of them. So you can't really, it sounds like you're sort of conflating issues here. However, when you look at what he did, I believe it was seven players and a caddy who were stuck in Dubai because of the war in the Middle East right now. I don't know if you ever, if you've like read these reports, but it is hundreds of thousands of dollars to get private planes in and out of Dubai to try to save people, to try to get them out of the war zone. It is not a small amount of money. So on one case, John Rahm is taking this odd principle stance that I will not pay my fines, which total $3 million. On the other side, it's I'll gladly play a couple hundred thousand dollars to rescue my friends from the Middle East from this terrible war that's going on. I found that fascinating. The winning part, though, is the part that really has me locked in. I think he's going to move to about 32 or 33 in the world ranking, which is going to get him closer to, I think, where we all expect him to be, or where we all think he should be, to be honest with you. But it had been, even he admitted, I read a couple quotes where he talked about this is the one that really takes the weight off his shoulders. Because externally, you and I and everyone else in the media have been talking about this for a long time. And what he has said publicly is, it'll come. I keep putting myself in contention. I'm not worried about it. Clearly, he was. When you see the relief, it almost had a hint of Rory McIlroy walking up the hill last year at the Masters, finally completing the career
just,
Grand Slam.
Just slightly different, but yes.
Tiny little hint to that, because he knows how much pressure had been building, as you pointed out, first win anywhere in the world on any tour since 2024. I'm not sure this opens up the floodgates, and I'm not even quite sure what it means, but certainly for John Rahm, it's a step in the right direction.
Yeah, and I think to your previous point about the strange dichotomy that happened basically over 24 hours of John Rahm hitting out at the European Tour, but then being incredibly generous and helping rescue these players. Like, human beings are very complex. They can have layers to them. John Rahm, I would say, is a very complex person, personality, and golfer as well. As it relates to John Rahm's golf, like, this was hugely important for him personally, just to have that weight, just, I think, so he's not arriving at Augusta being like, hey man, why can't you win? How have you not won anywhere since August 2024, which at this point that had been. John Rahm had four consecutive runner-up finishes on LIV, including two in a row to start the year. I think everyone was completely shocked at the way he folded to Anthony Kim down the stretch at LIV Adelaide. But I do think overall, when you look at what John Rahm has done now on the LIV circuit in 2026, second, first, like, that's about what I expected with LIV expanding from 54 to 72 holes. You give the best players more holes, the cream is going to rise to the top. And because LIV is so top heavy, John Rahm is doing what I expected John Rahm to do. You mentioned where Rombo rose in the official world golf ranking. I don't even look at that. It's going to be months, if not years, for him to catch up to where he probably should be.
But it's a good step. I think it's worth pointing out.
Yeah, and I always look at what our friends at Data Golf have. And they have John Rahm at number two in the world, behind Scotty, ahead of even Rory McIlroy. Only two finishes all year last year outside the top 15. It's essentially like dime store Scotty Scheffler and what he's been able to do on a worldwide circuit over the past 16 to 24 months. And I think, too, like, to tie this all together, Rahmbo can really leverage the situation here. Because if you're a world beater, the DP World Tour would very likely acquiesce to some of your demands. If I think both sides want Rahm to be on that European Ryder Cup team in 2027, they are going to make it as easy as possible for him if he can continue to prove himself as a world-class player. Remember what happened before Bethpage with Roy McIlroy saying, if John Rahm is not on that team, then the European Tour needs to bend their rules in order to accommodate him.
Well, and he changed his tune last week on that one. You need to be clear
they
on
certainly
that.
Did change.
You did. No, Rory changed his tune.
Yes. I'm saying Rory absolutely changed his tune. That's why I think it's imperative on John Rahm to continue to play well in 2026, because if he can establish himself as a former world number one type player, if he's winning 5, 6, 7 times, if it's clear far and away that he is the second best golfer on the planet, I think both sides will be even more motivated to put this behind them, potentially sort of make a Rahm rule. He's the one who thought he was going to trigger all the change with the PGA Tour and LIV and some sort of peace agreement. That never happened, sort of misplayed his cards in that respect. If Rahm wins 5, 6, 7 times in 2026, who's to say they won't trim the requirement just for him with just 4 tournaments?
I tend to agree with what Rory said about this situation last week. And he turned the question back on the reporter and said, what else does the DP World Tour need to do? They had negotiated in good faith and created a very clear pathway back. As Rory pointed out, that whatever sanctions Rahm faced weren't nearly as much as what Brooks Koepka faced to come back to the PGA Tour. Brooks Koepka essentially played a $5 million fine that went to charity. He can't play in the biggest events, the signature events. He can't get bonuses this year. He can't get player equity. All of those things are quote unquote punishments. And so when John Rahm says that, no, this feels like extortion, I don't know. I tend to disagree with what you're saying right here, because I don't know what else the DP World Tour could possibly do. And they've already sent the offer out. It's not as though they can circle back around and say, okay, John Rahm, we're going to try to give you another offer. Because then 8 players who agree to this deal are going to want to sweeten their deal. So I don't see how that happens. I think this turns into a staring contest. And as we get closer and closer to next year's Ryder Cup, I actually think it's probably going to be John Rahm who blinks.
Certainly possible. I just think in terms of a leverage situation, if you want to apply even more pressure to the DP World Tour to make this right, go out and win. Win repeatedly. Win dominantly. Win major championships. All of a sudden, I think then the pressure and the onus is back on the DP World Tour to try to make sure that this guy, who again, would be head and shoulders above everyone else on the European side, is playing by a different set of rules.
My understanding is Luke Donald was a little slow to come back for a third turn as a Ryder Cup captain because he wanted this issue resolved. He didn't want to have this on his plate. Well, again, the DP World Tour at least went to Luke in good faith and said, we tried to fix this, and John Rahm turned us down. I would be curious right now, if you're Luke Donald and everyone else in that team room who's planning for next year in Ireland, you would love to have John Rahm on that team. I don't know if he's a linchpin at this point. He's important to that team. I don't think he's going to make a difference in if they win or lose, though.
Fair enough. I certainly think they'd be a clear favorite, regardless of whether John Rahm is on that team. Certainly more potent if he is. Real quick, speaking of leverage.
Any more lists when
leverage.
It comes to Luke Goff, just because of that take. Please, no more lists.
No more lists. I got you. But I will say, speaking of leverage and something to monitor with the Masters now just a month away, we're still waiting for Bryson DeChambeau to pop his head up in 2026. He's only been competitive in one of the 3 LIV events so far. Got blown out of the water that Sunday at LIV Adelaide by not just Anthony Kim, who won the tournament. John Rahm outplayed him as well. Coming off now in Hong Kong, a pedestrian tie for 24th on a golf course that does not suit Bryson's game. His driver hasn't quite been the weapon that it has been statistically over the past couple years. He's garnered some attention in recent weeks because of the fracture of the relationship with LA Golf, which makes the shafts in his one-of-one equipment. Where are you on Bryson, Rex, and especially with the Masters about a month away and what he's done the past couple years there? There has to be some level of concern.
Yeah, I think there is a level of concern, more so less about the Masters and what he may or may not do in this major championship season, and more so about his future with LIV Golf is where I stand. Because you talk about leverage as it stands right now, as the understanding is this is Bryson's last year of his contract with LIV Golf. And based on all accounts, he was going to ask for the bank from LIV Golf if he was going to sign a new contract. And anyone who knows anything about business will tell you he had the leverage going into those negotiations. If he continues to struggle, I would imagine some version, some form of that leverage sort of gets chipped away. And I don't know if he's willing to give or if the other side is willing to give. But as far as his play right now in the heat of the moment, that doesn't necessarily concern me. You're right. It seems as if he has a lot of distractions in his world, but it always seemed like he had a lot of distractions in his world.
Yeah, he tends to thrive amid the chaos, does Bryce DeChambeau. As it relates to leverage, he's always an interesting one when you hear the numbers that have been thrown out, and a lot of that's just rumors and speculation and completely unfounded. But like, as it relates to Bryce DeChambeau's appeal for LIV, he's never going to be that circuit's best player. That's going to be Jon Rahm as long as Rahm is on LIV. I think Rahm is a generational talent. He'll go down as one of the best Europeans ever. It's uncertain, if not completely correlated, that like Bryson's star power has not translated to viewership, particularly as it relates to what's happening with the Fox deal here in the U.S. You would at least think, though, if you're Bryson, you need to be visible in 2026. You need to pop up at LIV events. You need to win LIV events. You need to pop up and be visible at major championships in 2026 if you are going to be demanding yeah. even these nine-figure paydays, which he seems to be in line for with all the pressure points that he's trying to put on LIV. All right, I can hear Tito is excited for Players' Championship Week. I'm excited. I'm wearing the Gold Man Swingman Players' Championship hoodie to get a starter for Players' Week.
That is not gray.
It is not gray indeed. I live about 12 minutes from TPC Sawgrass. You'll be making the drive from Longwood in the morning. You and I will both be on the Live From show that begins at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Press conferences from the TPC Sawgrass will be rolling through. You'll be getting some live to tapes. You'll be getting some early reports from players practicing. Brooks Koepka, who did not play again at the Arnold Palmer Invitational, expecting him to be on the grounds on Monday as he prepares for what PGA Tour is calling a major championship. Real quick, what has you most excited about the players?
Well, I always think when you look back at last year, the finish was fantastic. It probably wasn't the finish that you and I anticipated with J.J. Spahn and Rory McIlroy at a playoff.
Phenomenal, though.
On a cold Monday morning. But it was so entertaining. But what I'm looking forward to most is Brian Rolep is scheduled to speak with the media on Wednesday morning. And I think we've all anticipated this press conference. I don't know if he's going to have any details about what the schedule might look like or the tour might look like going forward. I think, based on what I'm hearing, it sounds to me it's going to be some more generalities. And he's more going to maybe paint a broad outline, you know, with broad brushstrokes. However, I think any time going forward he speaks about the dramatic change that we all know is coming to the PGA Tour, I'm going to gravitate to that.
Yeah, that's what I'm anticipating as well over the first couple of days. And I love this tournament. I'm unabashedly a fan of this golf tournament.
Is it a major?
Is saying it is not a major championship. I'm not going to change my viewpoint on that. And I'm sure I'll be articulating that each of the first 3 days at TPC Sawgrass. But I love this tournament. It's my favorite tournament of the year to cover. It's 12 minutes away. Friends and family come by. It's always an exciting finish. The golf course, I cannot stand as a player. Like, I think it is I think it's almost impossible for folks like you and I to really play this golf course well. But for the elite of the elite, the best of the best in the world at TPC Sawgrass, like it's a match made in heaven. It really doesn't favor anyone. You have to hit the shots. It's great theater. It's great competition. Love the golf course in terms of producing a high-level golf tournament. Yeah, Brian Rolep is going to dominate the first 3 days, and then we get what I believe is one of the best competitions of the year. All right.
I have a take, too. I'm going to uncork this next week. But I have a take on how I think it becomes a major. That's
oh, my goodness.
I did some reporting today at Bay Hill. I have a take. I think I have an idea.
Are you going to be unleashing this on Wednesday when we do a live midweek pod? Okay. Correct. We have to wait till Wednesday. Brian Rolep, again, is scheduled to meet with reporters on Wednesday. That's actually going to be not in the traditional press conference spot, sort of media center at TPC Sawgrass. It's going to be in the global home, which is what they call the PGA Tour headquarters, anticipating about roughly 1,000 PGA Tour employees to be there as well, showing their support for the new leader of the PGA Tour, who will be making his first State of the Players address. Remember, that was Jay Monahan in that seat a year ago. So here's what we have coming up the next couple of days for Rex and I. We'll both be on the pregame show Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Rex and I will be doing hits together Thursday, Friday. both on the show on Saturday, Sunday as well. On Wednesday, we're going to do one of these live YouTube shows. I will figure out how to use this chat. I see the comments coming.
I saw it come up at one point.
Yeah, I could not figure out how to do it. Okay. I was a little scared to do it. We will do that on Wednesday. It's going to be a lot of fun. Make sure you join us for that one. We'll set a time. Make sure you guys are all aware when we're going to be doing that show. Started beginning Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, we're going to be doing live mini pods on YouTube. And then Sunday, as usual, we'll be doing the 52-minute made-for-TV edition. Going to be a lot of fun. Tons to get to golfchannel.com for all of the latest news, notes, and updates from Rex and I as well. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lyle. We'll be on live from 3 p.m. Eastern time on Monday. Talk to you guys on Wednesday as well. Yes, we're doing it live on YouTube once again. We'll let you know.